Take your Bibles tonight, 1 Kings chapter number 19, 1 Kings 19. It has been great. I appreciated being invited to come. Always a blessing to be here. I don't know if you've paid attention, but the music has just been A1, top class. It has helped in preparing our hearts for the preaching. That isn't always the case. Do you know that there are some churches where the musician, the song leader, is in competition with a preacher? It's not been the case here. I don't know if you heard about this, but there was a church where the pastor and the choir director at the Hicksville Southern Baptist Church had a little feud that was going between them. Scenes, first hint of trouble came when the pastor preached on dedicating yourselves to service. And at the end of that, the choir director chose to sing, "I shall not be moved." Well, the people sensed that there was a problem going there, and so trying to believe it was just a coincidence, the pastor put the incident behind him, and that next Sunday he preached on giving. And at the end of the service, the choir director had the choir sing, "Jesus Paid It All." And so that pastor began to lose his temper that next Sunday morning. The congregation, it swelled in attendance. People came to see what was next, and the pastor preached on the sin of gossiping. The choir director leaded at the end of that service, "I love to tell the story." Well, by that next Sunday, there was no turning back, and that pastor told the congregation that unless something changed, that he was considering resignation. And the entire church gasped then when the choir director led them in "Why Not Tonight?" Well, truthfully, no one was surprised when that next Sunday the pastor resigned and he explained that Jesus had led him there and Jesus was leading him away. And the choir director had them saying, "What a friend we have in Jesus." May I say to you, what we've not seen any kind of a conflict like that, and thank God for it. I know that you're getting tired. I know that the week is progressing. And that's the whole purpose of a camp. You know, the very first night, you're not about to give up anything. By the end of the week, you will give up everything just for an hour more to sleep. It's all a plot to get the victory in your lives. 1 Kings chapter number 19, I feel impressed for us to consider another man that God greatly used. And I know that some of the messages that have been preached to this point have been to try to get a hold of our hearts, that maybe if there is some hidden sin that has been coddled and regarded, David said there, that it's time to give it up. And if it's not yet been given up, that's what God wants you to do. We have had some messages that have been addressed at teenagers and some even at children. But tonight I'd like to address a message to parents. And I say that because as a parent, and I am one, and many of you are parents tonight, I don't think we really understand the power of influence that we have on our children and our young people in preparing them at our home for God to use them in a greater way. I'd like to preach on this title tonight, How Elisha Was Prepared at Home. How Elisha was prepared at home. Let's begin by reading this text. Would you stand with me? I would like to read 1 Kings chapter number 19. If you would just follow as I read, I'm going to read verse 15 and verse 16 and then verse 19. Then we'll have a word of prayer. Again, if you would follow, I'll read verse 15. And the Lord said unto him, he's speaking to Elijah, "Go return on thy way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when thou comest, anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu the son of Nimshi shall thou anoint to be king over Israel." Pay close attention. "And Elisha the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah shall thou anoint to be prophet in thy room." Verse number 19, if you would. So he, that's Elijah, departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12, and Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, we thank you for each one that's here tonight. Maybe for some it's the first service of this camp meeting. For others, they've been here every night. Lord, whatever be the case, we pray that you would help us now to let the Spirit of God speak to our hearts. I pray, Lord, that we would seek to get something from you. And Lord, as you speak to each of our hearts, may we say, yes, sir. I'll do what you want me to do, dear Lord. I'll go where you want me to go. I'll be what you want me to be. Lord, help us to be willing servants for you. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. You may be seated. Again, I'm preaching tonight on how was Elisha prepared for God's call at home. Do you know that the name Elisha means God is Savior? And in the beginnings, Elisha was not a prophet. Elisha was a farmer from a little known northern tribe of Issachar. But God called this young man to leave that peaceful setting and to become a prophet to many people. Elisha had the honor of being trained by that veteran prophet Elijah. And if you recall, shortly before that chariot of fire took Elijah out, Elijah said to this young man, Elisha, he said, what would you like me to do for you? You name it and you can claim it. That was the last one that could quote that. And Elisha said, I would like a double portion of your spirit. And Elisha said, that's a tall request to make. But he said, if you will stick with me until God takes me out of here, God will grant that request. And Elisha did indeed stick with Elijah. And God did indeed give Elisha a double portion of God's blessing. Some have recorded the number of miracles that Elijah did in his lifetime, and they have come to the conclusion that Elisha did twice as many. If you know the story of Elisha, you know that he became a man of great faith, and he became a man of swift action, and he became a man of spiritual power, and he became a man of unwavering courage, and he became a man of clear understanding, and he became a man of remarkable foresight. And we read something like that sometime, and we come to the conclusion, that was then, and this is now. And may I say to you, that was then, and that still could be now. God has not changed. I know that the world has changed, and I know for the most part the world cares not for God. But God has not run out of power. God is still in the miracle-working business. But I say to you that I think that we would be taken back with how much Elisha was prepared for this supernatural call and prepared in his home. Now, what's amazing is that Elisha wasn't a prophet. In fact, Elisha wasn't even the son of the prophet, so he did not have any experience like that at all. If you would, you're in 1 Kings 19. Do you know that there were many other people that God could have picked to replace Elijah who were already prophets? Look there in 1 Kings 18, if you would. 1 Kings chapter 18 and verse number 4. 1 Kings 18 verse 4, for it was so when Jezebel cut off the prophets of the Lord that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50 in a cave and fed them with bread and water. This is just one chapter earlier. One chapter earlier, we're told of 100 prophets in that day. And we're told that 50 were hid in one cave and 50 were hid in another cave because the queen of the day, Jezebel, every prophet of God that she could find, she wanted to destroy. And so what I'm trying to say is there were 100 prophets presently with prophet experience that God could have picked to replace Elijah. But God stepped by all of those, and we're not told why, to pick this young man. And I would suggest to you that this young man was raised in a home just like many of ours. But this young man was blessed with parents who could see beyond these next weeks and next months and next years. And they wanted to incorporate some character into that son so that he would be usable in the hands of God. Preacher, how was Elisha prepared for God's call at home? Could I begin with 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse 19? So I'm saying to you who are parents, to we who are parents, if your children are still at home, there are some things that you could do in your home to make your children more usable and useful in the plan of God. Pastor, what? What is it that I could do? Well, look there in 1 Kings chapter 19 and verse number 19. The Bible says, so he departed thence, that's Elijah, and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. Could I say to you the very first thing, and if you're taking notes, and I'd recommend that you do, as far as how was Elisha prepared for God's call at home, first of all, Elisha's hands were kept busy at some task. Would you write that down? Elisha's hands were kept busy at some task. When Elijah set out to find his replacement, I want you to notice the next man to carry on that ministerial responsibility. I want you to notice where Elisha did not find that young man. He didn't find him in a pinball arcade. I don't know if this generation even knows what that is. He didn't find him spending his allowance playing these pinball machines and, well, I'm going to date myself now. He wasn't playing Pong. He wasn't playing Pac-Man. He wasn't playing Mario Brothers. He wasn't playing the 273rd level of whatever game you're on, level 271. Elijah didn't find his replacement in a pinball arcade. Elisha didn't go and find his replacement, even if you would, at a gym. He wasn't shooting baskets. Elijah didn't find his replacement at the drop-in center where he was socializing his way in idle talk. Elijah didn't find his replacement in the donut shop eating his fifth donut and drinking his 14th coffee. He did not find his replacement in the welfare line waiting for his monthly check. Look where he found him again, 1 Kings 19 and verse 19. So he, that's Elijah, departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing. Do you know, there's that one of those terrible four-letter words. It's called work. He was working. And I say, preacher, are you against pinball arcades? That's a whole different message. Preacher, are you against shooting hoops in a gym? Preacher, are you against all of those things? This is the middle of the daytime, folks. In the middle of the daytime, you ought to either be in school or you ought to be busy at work. I'm saying to you that Elisha's parents recognized the importance of Junior knowing how to work. And may God help we who are parents to recognize the importance of teaching our children how to work. Now, if I understand the passage, the father of Elisha was a farmer. And it would seem that he was a very wealthy farmer. And farmers in that day, they didn't have Massey Ferguson, and they didn't have John Deere, and they didn't have all of those equipment like that. They had oxen and simple plows. And so depending on how wealthy the farmer was, he had two ox and a plow that he was working through that field, came to the end and came back the second way. If he was a little wealthier, he might have had two of his servants there with four oxen or three teams Look at this one, if you would. 1 Kings 19 and verse number 19. We find, so he, Elijah, departed thence and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing with 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with a 12th. This father was so well-to-do that he owned 12 plows, and he had 24 oxen. And that father, that landowner, had 11 of his servants that were plowing that field. And I can only imagine that they were just offset just a bit, one behind the other. But what's interesting is the 12th, the one that was pushing, just lost the water, the one that was pushing the 12th was his own son. Dad didn't have to do that. Dad could have said, listen, it's my son and I want to keep his hands soft. After all, I want to hand him the business one day and I don't want him to be worn out. So apparently this father had listened to Dr. Oz and Dr. Dobson. He hadn't listened to all the psychology classes that said we need to protect our children from work. He recognized, if my child is going to make anything of himself, he's going to have to learn to work. And I would say we that are in the older generation were blessed with parents that had good sense just like that. I remember the first job that I had, and I can't tell about your life, I can only tell about mine, but my parents, we lived in Calgary, Alberta for 3 years. And my older brother and I, we had paper routes. Well, Calgary is not like Portage la Prairie, Manitoba. Portage la Prairie, Manitoba is flat. Our joke in Manitoba is you can see your dog running away for 3 days. And we have folks that actually travel from Winnipeg to church at our church. And they'll come in late and they'll apologize later. They said, preacher, I'm sorry, we left late. And we said, we knew that. We saw when you left. I'm saying to you that Manitoba is flat. But may I say to you that it's not flat everywhere. And I'm saying to you that this father said, my son is going to have to learn to work. Where'd we go? Calgary. If you've been in Calgary, it's not flat. And so my brother and I, we had these little red wagons. And we had 157 papers between us. And so when we get to the top of the hill with one leg in that little red wagon and all our papers wrapped up with elastic, we would have in the time of our life. And the problem was we forgot about that one house with Aunt Gertie that didn't like the paper in the driveway. And she wanted it put in the hooks of the mailbox, and we always remembered that at the bottom of the hill. And it was a terrible thing. All Thursday evening we collected. And we knock on doors. That was back in the day where you literally got money from the customer and you took it in. Now they do all that with internet. And we knew that people were at home until we knocked on the door and they looked out the window and they wouldn't answer. It was frustrating, but it was learning how to work. That was the first job. We moved back to Ontario, and my brother and I, at 6 in the morning, we delivered the Globe and Mail. And then the streets were dark at 6 in the morning. We had bikes that, I don't know if it'd be safe to do that anymore, but we were taught how to work. I know the next job I had was mowing lawns. I got a job mowing lawn for a farmer. His name was Oris Bartkew. And Oris Bartkew, he said, son, I'd like you to mow my lawn, and I'd like you to mow the company lawn. And he said, my mother has another farm lawn, and he said, how much do you want for it? And I said, well, how would I mow it the first time? And then we decide. I had a little bit of business sense to myself and wasn't going to commit myself before I knew much time. And so honestly, the first time I mowed a little slower. I was going to make sure that I didn't push myself too hard, make a good dollar on this thing. It took 3.5 hours for me to mow all those properties. So I went to him and he said, how much? I said, $7.50. And he looked at me and he said, $7. And I thought, well, we can both, you know, work to the middle on this thing. And I said, how about 7.25? And he said, $7. That's why I just came down 25 cents, sir. How about 7.25? He said, $7 is all you get. He handed me $7, and I rode my bicycle just mean and hateful all the way home. I came in that door, and my mother, bless her heart, she loved God and she loved me. And she said, "Son, what's wrong?" I said, "I am never mowing for that man ever again." And she said, "Tell me." So I told her the whole story. And she said, "Do you mean what's keeping you away from mowing that yard is 25 cents? I said, "That's right. And principle." She took a quarter out of her purse and flipped it at me. She said, "There you go." I said, "I refuse to let you pay for his quarter." And she said, "I refuse not to make you how to work." Thank God for parents that recognize their children need to work. Do you know when you get in the ministry, it's work? I kid with our people, and sometimes people wonder, what do preachers do all week? And so I said, we golf all day Tuesday, and we play bingo all day Thursday. And I had someone come to me, and they said, "Brother Carlson, are you honest that you golf all day Tuesday and you play golf all day Thursday?" I said, "No." I said, "My golfing day is Thursday. My bingo is Tuesday." Now, you'd have to be a pastor or have been a pastor to know it's work to be in the ministry. You'd have to be a bus worker to know it's work to build a bus route. You'd have to have been a Sunday school teacher to know it's work to build a Sunday school class. And if you think you're doing your children a favor by not having them work, you are not preparing them for the ministry. When I was in Bible college there in North Carolina, I had to work. After I graduated from Bible college, waiting for God to open that door, learned how to work. I'm saying to you this evening, as parents, don't we have a desire that our young people, our children, that God will use them and take them to the next step in the ministry? I don't think we have any idea how much influence that we have upon that decision ever being made. Could I say not only he learned the importance of labor, but could I say he also learned the importance of ownership? Look there, if you would, in verse number 20, when Elijah approached Elisha, verse number 20, and he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee." And he said unto him, "Go back again, for what have I done to thee?" And he, that's Elisha, returned from him and took a yoke of oxen, slew them, and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose. I read that last verse, number 21, after Elisha sensed that God was wanting to do something with him. He went back home and he took the oxen and he slayed them. And he took that plow and he made with that plow an altar and he sacrificed. I don't think he would have done that unless he owned those oxen. So those parents not only trained that boy labor, but they trained that boy ownership. We don't do any favors if we just simply hand our children everything that they ever ask for. They'll get lazy and sluggardly because, after all, they didn't have to work to get it. But if they have been trained to work and trained to labor, they will value what they have. They won't trash it near as quickly. I had a preacher friend also in Manitoba. He was talking about his son, and his son, he wouldn't even buy his son candy. What a brutal father. Wouldn't even buy his son candy. His son had to work for money to buy candy. He bought 3 jawbreakers. And he put one of those jawbreakers in his mouth, and that boy's face just contorted. And it said a message, "This is horrible." And his dad said, "What's wrong with you, son?" He said, "Dad, this is terrible." And he said, "Well, son, spit it out." He said, "I can't. I paid for it." We need to teach him how to work. We need to teach him the value of a dollar. We need to teach him ownership. It's human nature for all of us to take the easy road. I think you'd understand that. My son, I have 3 children. They're all gone from home, and the middle of the 3 is my son. His name is Ben. It's always been his name. His name is Ben, and And he came to me at age 14 and he said, Dad, he said, I would like to buy a dirt bike. Now, folks, we live in the city. What are you going to do with a dirt bike in the city? Well, I'm trying to be a little gentle here. I said, son, what are you going to do with it? We live in the city. He said, Dad, he said, we do have some farmers in our church. And I said, which one are you thinking of? He said, well, you mentioned the name. And I said, they live 10 miles out of town. And I said, how are you going to get there? I said, son, I work 25 hours a day at the ministry. I said, I can't take you there. How are you going to get there? Oh, he said, Dad. He said, my friends, they all have dirt bikes, and they just ride them in the ditches, those 10 miles to get out there. And I said, son, I don't think that's legal. And he said, oh, yeah, Dad, my friend said it is. That's like Rehoboam talking to his friends. That's what we're dealing with. So I took him with me. We had to do a couple of tasks, and I stopped by the motor vehicle branch, and I pulled the booklet out on page 21. It was going to tell him it's not illegal. It's not legal. And I went to the bank, and I said, son, I got to do some banking here. And I said, why don't you just kind of look through this, but probably stop around page 21. Went inside, did the banking, came back. He said, well, I still think it's okay. I said, what did page 21 say? Son, you're 14. Can't do it till you're 16. He said, well, I think it'd still be okay. They probably don't know what they wrote. I said, okay. I said, let's go to the RCMP. That's the police. And he said, what for? I said, let's ask them whether these people made a mistake in what they wrote. And we went there, my son and I, and we walk in there, and I say, you know, between all the cages and the plexiglass, I said, ma'am, I said, my son here is interested in getting him a dirt bike, and I said, he wants to drive it through the ditches 10 miles out of town. Could you tell me if that's legal? And she said, well, sir, before I answer that, I want to check with one of the constables. And I said, help yourself, go for it. I said, now, Ben, are you ready for whatever they're going to say? He said, I know what they're going to say, Dad, it's okay. I said, okay. This lady comes back, she starts scolding me. He can't ride that through the ditch. I said, man, hold on. You don't have to convince me. You have to convince him. Son, you cannot do that. That's illegal because you'd have to cross each one of those roads in those 10 miles, and we know you won't. Boy, my son was livid. He was mad at the woman. He was mad at the booklet. He was mad at Dad. He was furious. He didn't talk to me for 2 days. After 2 days, he came to me and he said, Dad, if you won't let me buy a dirt bike, I've got another plan. And I thought, well, what are we going to do with this? He said, I would like to buy a lawnmower. I said, son, you can't ride a lawnmower. He said, no, Dad, if you won't let me buy a dirt bike and spend time hot-dogging around with my friends, I'm going to buy a lawnmower, and I'm going to make some money. Yes. I said, son, that will do you better the rest of your... Now, listen, if you have a dirt bike, if you're convicted, come to the altar. I'm not preaching against your dirt bike if you live in the country. If you're on the 14th floor of a condo in Toronto, you might need to come forward. Do you know, I said to my son, he'd already done the homework. I said, what do you pay for a lawnmower? He said, Dad, the one I'm going to get is a Toro. He said, it'll cost me $700. I've never paid $700 for a lawnmower in my life. I said, really? He said, Dad, that's the one to get. I said, son, if it costs you $700, I tell you what, I'll make a deal. You pay $500, I'll pay all the rest, all the tax, all the rest of that. I said, preacher, why would you do that? I wanted him to learn how to work. Short order, he got the lawnmower, and he mowed lawns in our street and the street on either side. And he said, Dad, I've got some potential customers about 8 or 9 streets. I said, son, you can't push your lawnmower 9 streets. He said, I could. I said, we need to get a little trailer for the back of your bike. You know, we look for trailers. There is sold one out of Guelph, Ontario. I was a salesman before I became a pastor. I used every sales gimmick in the book. They wouldn't take Canadian Tire money. They wouldn't take anything like that. I said, Ben, it's going to cost you $500 to buy that trailer, to hook the back to the bike, to haul that lawnmower anywhere in our city. He said, if that's what it's going to take, that's what we'll do. I said, son, if you want to do that, if you pay half, I'll pay the other half, all the tax and all the shipping. Dad, why would you do that? Because, son, you need to know how to work. When I had said no about the dirt bikes, he lived 24 hours a day, envious of the other young men in our church that lived out in the country that could have a dirt bike. And do you know when he started that lawn mowing business, he started making, we're not talking about $5 or $10 or $20. He was making $100 a week and then $200 a week. And I was thinking of retiring and going on parental leave. He made up his part of the purchases very quickly. In short order, before he turned 16, he paid for his Dodge Ram cash. You know what the other boys that lived out in the country were saying to their dads? I wish we could move to the city so we could start a lawn mowing business, so we could pay for our own truck cash. We don't do our children any favors if we just hand over everything that they ask. His home prepared him for the ministry. I say the first thing, I trust that you have written that down. I say the first thing is, how was Elisha prepared for God's call at home? First of all, Elisha's hands were kept busy at some task. I give you a second thing. Look there in 1 Kings 19 and the last part of verse 19. The last part of verse 19, Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle on him. That's on Elisha. And he, that's now Elisha, left the oxen and ran after Elijah. If you would, adding on to what we've already learned, this father had good sense in training his son to be the 12th with that team of oxen, and he is going up and down this row working with the other 11 servants and their oxen. And Elijah is leaning against, I suppose, a sycamore tree, and Elijah is watching the zeal of this young man and the labor of this young man and the fervency of this young man. And God says to Elijah, that's the one, that is your replacement. And so all that happens is Elisha, as he's going down, Elijah takes off his, I know it says mantle, but he takes off his mantle. And what he does is he just simply throws his mantle on the shoulder of Elisha as Elisha is moving down. Now, for you men that have three suits, we have so many clothes today, it wouldn't be a big deal if someone threw their coat on your shoulder. If it was your size, you'd probably run with it. But you understand that a prophet's mantle was a statement. That was a statement of the call of God on his life. It was a statement that he was serving the Lord God of Israel. And I don't think Elisha really understood all that that mantle thrown on his shoulder meant. But you know what he could have done when that man of God did that? He could have taken that mantle and thrown it off and just keep plowing. But he didn't. What he did was he stopped with that oxen and he ran back to Elijah to find out what that meant. Would you write this down? Secondly, the second way that Elisha was prepared for God's call at home was Elisha's heart was kept anxious for the spiritual. Elisha's heart was kept anxious for the spiritual. And so I'm saying when that mantle was thrown on Elisha, Elisha stopped his plowing, ran after the departing Elijah. Did Elisha know all that that mantle meant? I don't think he fully knew, but I think that he desired to know. Dad, Mom, if you have been successful in incorporating the work ethic into your children, have you done that at the expense of a priority of spiritual values in your children? There are some that win on the work. Now, if we don't teach them the work ethic, they're going to learn the shirk ethic. You say, well, preacher, I've been successful in teaching my children how to work. Have you done that at the expense of a spiritual priority? Have they worked so hard that now they work on Sundays when they should be in the house of God on Sundays? Are they so anxious to work that all the money that they earn in the work, they never give God his portion for what they've earned? And I'm saying that these parents had not only been successful in training this son of theirs about his hands kept busy at some task, but secondly, Elisha's heart was kept anxious for the spiritual. I'm told that years ago, farming communities parked their tractors on Saturday night because Sunday was God's day. Farmers knew that Sunday was God's day, and short of having some kind of emergency, God got God's day. I'm told that stores used to be closed on Sunday. Shops would display the close sign during revival nights. People knew that as much as work was important, God was more important, church was more important, revival was more important. Little leagues were not scheduled for Sunday. Christians, if they were, Christians didn't participate in them. Bowling didn't take place on Sunday. The Grey Cup wasn't attended on Sunday. The Stanley Cup wasn't planned for Sunday. I'm saying to you, there was a time when God got his day. How many have lost that? Now again, I'm not your enemy. Say, well, it sure sounds like it. It sounds like you're angry. No, I'm projecting my voice. If you work at a job and you have shifts and that shift puts you on, you're not my enemy and I'm not yours. But if they come to you with overtime and say, we'll give you double time on Sundays, and you can say no. Say no. Be a great testimony if you say no. I worked at Loblaws. First year and a half I worked at Loblaws, I brought in shopping carts. What a glorious calling. It was in the winter with the snow and the slushy snow at Penn Center there in St. Catharines, Ontario. Just a grunting with 14 shopping carts. And you know what? In the winter particularly, the women planned it. There would be 15 women inside the entrance of Loblaws, and I was bringing in 14 carts. And the 15th woman that was cartless, she was also heartless. And she would put her hands on her hips and she would say, where is my cart, sonny boy? I wanted to tell her where her cart was. Do you know how many times they came to me and said, we're doing an inventory on Sunday? And they said, Robert, you get to be paid double time. Well, it's not me. I said, I won't be here. And they said, well, why not? I said, God gets my Sunday. I'm in Sunday school and Sunday morning and Sunday evening. I cannot come. And they didn't understand it. They said, that's craziness. That's foolishness. I said, that might be so, but won't be here. He said, preacher, it's just one time a year. One time always leads to two. And two to four, and four to eight, and eight to 12, and finally you're, fully signed up for Sundays. I'm saying to you that those parents realized we better not lose the spiritual. And so they kept the heart of that young man tuned in to the being anxious for the spiritual. And Dad and Mom, short of a miraculous intervention, our children will never be more spiritual than us. Let me say that one again. Every generation, it seems that the notch is just a little bit lower. Short of a supernatural intervention of God, therefore, you're going to have to crank up that mark as high as you possibly can if your children will never reach where you're at. And you open the door for the almighty dollar to be a reason that they miss the house of God. And you'll live to the day where you regret it, because all the double time wage that they earned will be spent likely on foolish things. But they'll have lost that connection with God in doing so. How are your children doing with work? How are your children doing with God? I give you a third thing. How else was Elisha prepared for God's call at home? Again, I think that many of our children, and I know there are exceptions, I understand, but many of our children, I think that their spiritual maturity is really a reflection of what they saw in their home. I heard of a visit to the children's Bible class. A visiting evangelist looked into the very serious faces of those little children. And he said to these little children, he said, "Why do you love God?" That's a profound question to ask a five-year-old or a six-year-old. Why do you children love God? And you know, after just a few moments, one little child raises his hand and the evangelist says, "Why do you love God?" That little boy says, "I guess it just runs in our family." Dad and Mom, if you love God, there's a good chance they will. If you tolerate God, there's a good chance they'll tolerate God. So I don't think we can win on the second one unless they see in their parents a love for God, a priority for God. Let me give you the third one. See, do you just have three? That would be telling. That's a preacher's secret. I give you a third thing. Look there in 1 Kings 19 and verse 20. 1 Kings 19 and verse 20. So Elijah's now thrown his mantle on Elisha. Look there in verse 20. And he, that's Elisha, left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee." You know, the devil's doing everything he can to pull apart our families. And if he can't hinder the emphasis that we must have to teach our children how to work and how to love the Lord, do you know Satan will see to it that in our teaching of all those things that we become mechanical and lose the personal touch. Isn't it a sweet thing when a little three-year-old says, "Daddy, I love you"? That little girl says, "Mama, I sure love you." That's great when they're three. It's often a missing thing when they get to be 13. To get a 23-year-old to hug his mother, that's a great accomplishment. And if you do it, God bless you for it. Do you know, in all of this teaching how to work and teaching how to love God, the third thing that this home taught this young man is Elisha's home was kept sweet for each other. It was kept sweet for each other. And Elisha said, "Now look at this. This Elisha, he's not three. He's not 13. I dare say he's probably 20s. Look what he said after this mantle thrown on his shoulder. Verse number 20, "Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother." There was still a love in that home. Is there still love in your home? Haven't you seen that in the homes, in a sour home,
Those children have trouble believing that God can really love them. In a sarcastic home, children have trouble believing that God can care about them. In a sensual home, children have trouble believing God is holy and demands holiness. In a sullen home, that's a sad home, many have trouble believing God can be enjoyable. I'm saying our children need us and they need our love, and our supplying them food and clothing and shelter is not enough. Do your kids know that you love them? Did you just have a blast with them? They should. It's good. I read about four children that were bragging on their dads. They were sitting outside the room as a parent-student-teacher meeting. And as the parent was in there talking to the teacher, the four children, one of them said, "Well, my dad's a doctor, and that's why he's not here tonight. But you know, he makes lots of money, and that's why we have a swimming pool in our backyard." Second boy said, "Well, my dad's a lawyer. That's why he's not here. But he often travels to Washington and talks to presidents." And the third child said, "Well, my dad owns a company, and that's why he's not here. But we have our own airplane." And the fourth child, whose dad was a common laborer, said, "My dad is none of those things, but my dad is here tonight." You're going to do your children a favor by more than just giving them stuff. They need your love. They need our compassion. And this boy didn't hesitate at all to say to that man of God, "I'm going to follow you, but I want to go kiss my dad and kiss my mom." Yeah, get it? There's not strife in that home. You say, "Oh, preacher, I wouldn't kiss my dad." Well, he would. There's just that love there. Not just a love for God, but a love for them. Could I give you fourth thing? Look there, if you would, in 1 Kings 19 and verse 20. "And he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, 'Let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee.' And he said unto him, 'Go back again, for what have I done to thee?' And he returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments of the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him." Did Elisha know all that God had in mind for him that day? I don't think so. But he was willing to say, "Yes, God." Oh, if we just say, "God, yes." I want you to see who else was willing for Elisha to say yes to God. His parents. Would you write, a little wordy, but if you write this down, Elisha's hesitation wasn't the opposition for following God. Again, Elisha's hesitation wasn't the opposition for following God. Do you know that young man who wasn't completely understanding of what this mantle meant? I'm sure there was some trepidation and fear in his heart. I'm sure that he probably felt inadequate. I mean, this probably has something to do with ministry, and I've never been involved in ministry. I've just been the son of a farmer. I'm sure there was hesitation in his heart about inexperience for the ministry. Because Elisha, we don't have any record of him doing any kind of ministry, there might have been a hesitation in his heart that he wouldn't have, you know, he didn't have all of his Bible doctrine straight. Maybe he hesitated with that. But you know what his hesitation was not? That when I go home and tell my dad and tell my mom what I think that God is doing in my life, they won't put the brakes on it. They won't throw a bucket of water on that thought. I've taken our teens away to teen camp. I've seen the excitement of some of our teens. I've seen that they've turn the page and just want to give it all for God. And in the van traveling back, I said, you know, this Sunday night, we'd like to give you all, give you time for a testimony. And I've had young men that said, preacher, I'll do anything that you want, but I can't give a testimony if my dad is there, because my dad will stop me from serving God. Isn't that a heartbreak? Listen, folks, our children ought to know that if there is a tweak of interest in their heart, that we as parents are going to fan it. That we're going to say, go for it. All the way. I'm with you. I'm for you. And I think that young man was convinced, as much as he wasn't convinced that he was capable. I think he was convinced that dad will not stand in my way, he'll help. Mom won't stand in my way, she'll help. What a gift to give to our children. What a gift. Now listen, we can't call them. God is in the calling business. They can volunteer for many ministries, and there is no harm in that, but quite honestly, you want God to call them if it's full-time ministry, because the ministry is just a tear-jerking, heart-wrenching thing to be in, and it's only God's call that will keep you in it. But that boy, he said, I gotta go kiss my dad and kiss my mom. And he was just confident that those parents would say, good on you, son. Now, I know as parents, sometimes we have plans for our children. I know that. But do they know that the desires that you might have for them is totally in the hands of God to veto it? They should know. That's a great gift. After I graduated from Bible College in 1983, I returned to my hometown, home church, Niagara Falls, Ontario. I was just waiting for what's next. There were people that graduated from the same school, little school, that I did, and one went to be a youth pastor there in Florida, and others went different directions, and they'd say, Carlson, what are you going to do? And I said, I have no idea. Well, then what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to return to my country. I'm going to return to my home church. I'm going to wait on God. And that's what I did. And for the next 7 years, I was the song director for part of that time, and the treasurer, and taught in the Christian school and all of that. But every step of that, when the pastor would approach me and said, son, would you? And I would always say this. I said, preacher, I've never done that. He said, listen, he said, I believe you can. I said, since I still live at home and depend upon my parents, if you'd allow me, I'd like to talk to my parents first. And I wasn't fearful to do that, because I knew that my dad and my mom would say, go for it. You want to prepare your children for the ministry. Let them know that you would be thrilled. Whether it's a giant step or just a little baby step. Dad, I've been asked if I would help out on the Sunday school bus route. What do you think of that, son? Dad, I'd like to do it. Go for it. Be the best bus helper that they've got. Mom, our primary Sunday school teacher has asked if I could be a help in her Sunday school department. That mom says to that daughter, what do you think about that? That girl says, I don't know if I'm able to, but I'd sure like to try. Go for it, honey. Be the best Sunday school helper that there is. Folks, let's not be the wet blanket to douse how much we're pleading for this next generation to take the next step forward for God. Let's not be the reason that they hesitate on that. I give you the next one if I could. How else did they prepare? We have already seen Elisha's hands were kept busy at some task, and Elisha's heart was kept anxious for the spiritual, and Elisha's home was kept sweet for each other, and Elisha's hesitation wasn't the opposition for following God. I know, parents, that once in a while we have to be the tough guy. I know that. Remember, I was a tough guy when I wouldn't let my son buy a dirt bike. He, to this day, thanks me. He said, Dad, thanks. Thanks. Your children enjoy you. I know you have to be tough one, but they enjoy you. Heard about this family. You read so much, you don't know what's true or what's not true, so I'm going to say it's true, but I'm not sure it's true. I read of the family in the East was planning a several-week vacation to the West Coast in the States. At the last minute, though, the father's work responsibilities prevented him from going. But Mom, knowing that that had happened before, she insisted that they were capable of driving and that she and the kids would go ahead anyway. So Dad got out all the maps and planned out the entire route where the family would stop each night, and Mom and the kids left and had a fabulous time. Well, Dad, turns out, days into their vacation, Dad completed his extra work responsibilities, and he decided he wasn't going to call them, that he was going to surprise that family. So he took a plane, he flew out to the West Coast, and he did that without calling them. He then took a taxi from the airport out into the country on a highway that, according to his travel plan, his family was going to be driving by later that same day. That taxi driver said, are you sure you want me to drop you off here? There's nothing in miles from here. He said, yes, this is the spot. Taxi driver dropped him off and on the side of the road, and Dad waited there until, sure enough, he saw a family car that was coming. And as he saw that car coming, he stood there on the side of the road, and he has his thumb out hitchhiking. And his wife and the children, they drove past, and they all took a double take. And he said, didn't that look like Dad? And one of the kids said, yeah, that was Dad. And Mom said, should we pick him up or keep going on without him? And they said, Mom, it's always better if Dad is with us. If our kids say that, we've won. I know you have to be a tough guy. I understand that. If they love you and they love God because they see you love God, if you train them how to work and you've actually come to the place where they're thankful that you've taught them how to work, if they still love you and those signs of affection are still shown once in a while, and if they're not afraid to tell you, God wants me to take the next step, if they're not afraid that you're going to stop them, you've won. Could I get you to turn to 2 Kings, my last point? 2 Kings, would you look there in 2 Kings chapter 13? 2 Kings chapter number 13, of course, after all of this, Elisha did take Elijah's place. 2 Kings chapter 13 and verse number 14. And we read in that verse, now Elisha was fallen sick. Stop right there. Do you know from the time that Elijah threw his mantle on Elisha's shoulder, 60 years have now passed. 60 years have now passed, and that young prophet is now become an old prophet. Elisha's an old man. Again, 2 Kings 13, verse 14. Now Elisha was fallen sick of his sickness, whereof he died. While this old man Elisha was sick, the king of Israel found out. And Joash, the king of Israel, came down unto him. and wept over his face and said, "Oh, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof." We've now reached the end of Elisha's life. Here in verse 14, it says he's sick, and that sickness is going to take his life. And when the king of Israel, Joash, comes, hears of it, he comes and he weeps on Elisha's face. Do you know what that tells me? In spite of all of the opposition that Elisha faced in the ministry, he didn't quit. Too many that have volunteered in the ministry are no longer in the ministry. Some are out of the ministry because of immoral decisions. Some are out of the ministry because they just got tired of the opposition. Some are out of the ministry because they just lost heart for the work of God. But here at the end of Elisha's life, he is still a prophet of God. And I can't help but wonder whether he was still in the fight because his parents, who no doubt had long previous passed away, that they didn't give up either. Dad, Mom, you want to be a profound influence on your children? Just don't give up. Just don't stop. You see, preacher, sometimes I feel like it. Get in line. It's a long line. There's many that feel just like that. But you will be a great support and a great help and a great anchor if you just keep at it. The last thing, if you'd write this down, we find out that Elisha's heavenly influence lasted the rest of his life. Elisha's heavenly influence lasted the rest of his life. We don't have time to do it, but even after Elisha died, he still had an influence. I'd sure like my children to live for God for their whole life. But how could I expect that if I don't live for God my whole life? You say, Brother Carlson, you've given five things, and preacher, I've tried to do all five of those things. And I have a child or children in my home that they didn't want it. Some of us would have to testify that statement. But I say to you that as long as there is breath in their lungs, as long as their heart still beats, there's still hope. You can have a broken heart, but with a broken heart, don't quit. You can be embarrassed with the choices that maybe a child or children have done, but don't you quit. Your persistence, and maybe only your persistence, will be what brings them back one day. Many years ago, there was a revival meeting being held, and some decisions were made, and others there thought that maybe even revival couldn't help them. One night, God miraculously turned all of their thinking. For in that very last row of the church, there stood up a man. He was a tall man. He was slightly bent. He had been a senior preacher way up into his 70s. And he wanted to tell the folks in that church to give up on God, to never give up on God. And he said, "Would you please give me just a couple minutes?" He said, "You know my wife," and he looked there at his wife sitting. And he said, "You know my wife and I were married when I was 24 and she was just 22. And for a long time, the Lord withheld the blessing of a child from us. Then a boy came, my boy, a beautiful boy, a blessed boy. We loved him. We worshiped him. We adored him, maybe even too much. And the man said, I was a pastor of a very wealthy church, and I guess my boy was spoiled, and when he got to be four, he became very ill of a nameless sickness, and there was no doctor that could diagnose what he had. Our family physician called in some of the mightiest specialists of the country, but he said nothing could be done. That four-year-old boy lay stretched out in his bed, and he became, in short order, a wasted skeleton. He said one Sunday afternoon, the deacons came into that room, and the chairman of the deacons hesitantly said, Brother Pastor, we had a meeting, and we're going to recommend in the church service tonight that you be given a leave of absence indefinitely with full pay, and we will take care of your supplies, and we want you to take your wife and boy, and we want you to go anywhere that you want to find healing, and then bring him back. He said, we had prayer. That night, the deacons did stand before the church, and the church voted in favor of the arrangement. And an offering was taken amounting to little more than $2,000. He said, a day or two later, my wife and I gathered up our effects, and we started out. For the next 8 long months, we traveled up and down our continent trying to find a cure, but all to no avail. He said, we came back, put that little tiny skeleton to bed to die. The family physician came every day, sometimes twice a day. At times he spent a good part of the day right there with the boy, but there seemed to be nothing that he could do. One day the doctor walked into my study and said, Brother Pastor, you need to come with me now into your lad's room. He's dying. He said, we hurried in there to the bedside of my son. I stood there holding the hand of my wife. What could I do? After a while, the doctor took his coat off and rolled up his sleeves and opened up his little doctor's kit and took out a hypodermic needle. And he put on rubber gloves and filled the needle with some kind of gray fluid. The doctor watched the patient. That boy began to get more and more pale, and in a bit, he stiffened out and stopped breathing. The doctor plunged that needle into that boy's body. That boy opened his eyes and gritted his teeth. He commenced breathing harshly again. The doctor watched him, his fingers on the boy's pulse, and minutes passed. The doctor gently put that boy's hand down. He started rolling down his sleeves. He buttoned them up. He reached for his coat. He said, Brother Pastor, the boy's dead. An old man in the back of that service said, Gentlemen, the doctors gave up on my boy, but he said, I turned to my wife. I said, Honey, light the oven. Get every blanket and comforter that you can find and heat them up and bring them here. That old preacher that stood at the back, he said, I opened my coat and I unbuttoned my shirt. And he said, I tore my undershirt apart. And he said, I picked up that little cooling body of my son. And he said, I pressed it against my hot, sweating body. And he said, my wife brought that first blanket and wrapped that blanket around us. And he said, in just a few minutes, it got cool. And so she brought another one and wrapped it around us. And she brought a third one and wrapped it around us. And he said, we kept that up for 9 hours. We weren't going to give up on our son. He looked down as he gave his testimony. He looked down at his wife and he smiled. He stepped a little forward in that aisle. And he raised his hand to God. And he said, the last traces of life were not lost. For God brought that boy back to life again. And he said, That boy has been preaching the gospel for 17 years. Don't give up. There are some things that you can do while they're still at home. But they still have a choice. And even when they make the wrong choice, he said his boy had been preaching for 17 years. Your son or your daughter, they're in the far country. As long as there's breath in their body, as long as their heart is beating, don't you give up. Your head's bowed and your eyes closed tonight.